This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, another look at the issue of wolf hunting in Michigan. But first, we discuss what Friday's federal appeals court decision upholding Michigan's ban on same-sex marriage and last week's election means for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. Emily Diefendorf is director of the gay rights advocacy group, Equality Michigan. Emily Diefendorf, thank you very much for being with us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
So when you heard about Friday's appeals court ruling, what was your reaction? What do you think it means for the issue of gay marriage going forward in Michigan?
Friday's decision certainly was a disappointment. We were understandably upset about the decision and that we don't like to see the court hand it back to the states, because we do feel that the federal court has a responsibility to stand up for the people, and especially the underserved people and those that are vulnerable and who are targeted for discrimination because they are in the minority, because often they are the ones who are underserved and underrepresented by the democratic process already. They are unlikely to be defended by the democratic process and those in leadership in the democratic process. So to hand it back to the democratic process, which was the decision was that it was not the most appropriate route for the courts to handle marriage equality, that they felt it was most appropriate for the democratic process to sort through marriage equality in each state at whatever pace the democratic process would approach marriage equality. So essentially, whatever the social political climate was in the state, that the people and that the government in the states would handle it in those states appropriately, and that just go with the natural evolution, the natural flow of society and of history. And we feel that's not how it happens in history when a population is targeted for discrimination, that there comes a point when the courts have to act, because the courts tend to be the ones that have to take the lead on what is moral and what is just, because the majority and our democratic process doesn't tend to set the standard when it comes to doing the right thing for the minority. So we were disappointed. However, it does give us the opportunity to go directly now to the U.S. Supreme Court, and that is what we intend to do.
If the Supreme Court ruling were to come back in such a way that it does not overturn Michigan's ban on gay marriage, do you think it is time for a petition drive to try and change Michigan's constitution?
That is an excellent question. We do know that if there is an appeal filed to the U.S. Supreme Court soon, and when I say soon, I mean by January of 2015, that it is likely that we may know something by June of 2015. So we, pretty soon here, that's before the end of this U.S. Supreme Court session, may have a resolution to this question of marriage equality for the nation. So we would like to see if we have a solution to the question of marriage equality in the states, including Michigan and those other states, by June of 2015. However, of course, if there is not an answer to that question, if the U.S. Supreme Court comes back without an answer to that question, then we will continue to pursue getting marriage equality in Michigan through every route that we possibly can. And we've always said that if that means going to the ballot, then that is one of the routes that we will pursue. We've been working on laying that foundation, and we certainly know how to go to the ballot, and we will wait to see if the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be willing to give that resolution to us. They've certainly given indications that they are leaning that way, and we do believe that that's what they would probably do, that they would rule in our favor, but if they don't, then we are absolutely willing to go to the ballot.
In 2004, the ban on same-sex marriage was approved by a pretty healthy margin. How confident are you that the election results would be different this time around if there were to be another ballot initiative and another question on the ballot about gay marriage in Michigan?
We are absolutely confident that we would win full marriage equality if we were to put it on the ballot again. And that's because the polling on marriage equality has shifted 180 degrees since 2004, when the ban against same-sex marriage in Michigan was put into place. In 2004, it is true that the majority of Michiganders polled in favor of a ban against same-sex marriage. So those who went to the polls to put the ban in place were on the same page as most Michiganders. Most Michiganders were wanting a ban on same-sex marriage. However, now the majority of Michiganders poll in favor of repealing that ban. They also poll in favor of putting into place full marriage equality. So they, at this point, feel they made a mistake. 10 years later, just 10 years later, and that's really pretty quick. They feel like they made a mistake when they put that ban into place, and they both want to repeal that ban and put into place, replace it with full marriage equality. And that is stunning, but also not surprising, because at this point in history, just about everybody knows somebody who is lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. And that is something that has happened very quickly. The LGBT community is much more visible, and we all know somebody that we love and that we care about or that we work with, and we have a stake in protecting them and making sure that they are happy and have access to stability. And now we want to see fairness happen in our state.
In last week's election, there were two openly gay members elected to the state house. That includes John Hoadley for the district, which includes the city of Kalamazoo. What does that mean for the issues that you're trying to pursue going forward, that there are now two openly gay members of the House, where there had not been an openly gay member of the legislature since 2007?
Yes. And formerly it had been Chris Cole. And now we have John Hoadley out of Kalamazoo, and we have Jeremy Moss out of Southfield. And, you know, I have to acknowledge that both are friends of mine. And John Hoadley, you are so lucky to have him, because he is brilliant and has an incredible amount of energy and a great dedication to Kalamazoo. So that is my endorsement as a friend. But aside from just the incredible people that you have coming to the legislature, it means a great deal to the progress of equality issues to have out LGBT people in office for a couple of reasons. When you have out legislators in office, it actually speeds the progress of equality issues, because you have other legislators who are getting to know LGBT people. And studies have shown when you get to know LGBT people, you feel an accountability to LGBT people. You have to see them across the room from you when you're voting, and you're less likely to vote against LGBT people when those issues come up, because you know exactly what damage you're doing. You're also more likely to vote for issues that will help LGBT people, because you know what is at stake. And you also have LGBT people in office who are able to represent the needs and to speak on exactly what it is that needs to be done for LGBT people, of course, the representation that John Hoadley and Jeremy Moss will bring to the House of Representatives is the obvious benefit. But they have expertise in other areas, of course, but they also have the experience. They also bring the community, and those are invaluable. Those are invaluable, and studies show it speeds the progress of the possibility of equality for Michigan, just them being there and legislators knowing them.
There's been a lot of talk about amending the state's Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act and adding protections for sexual orientation and gender identity that may come up during the so-called lame duck session before the end of the year. What would changing that law mean for the LGBT community in Michigan?
And we do expect that it will likely be taken up. This is going to be a very fast few weeks that we see coming up here at the end of November, the beginning of December. We have put a lot of work in the last couple of years. Actually, we've been trying to amend the State Civil Rights Act for 30 years. We've had the amendment to include sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression introduced for 30 years now. And we have been recruiting businesses to support and faith leaders and Republicans really actively for the last few years, especially. And it looks like there is a really good chance that it will pass by the end of this year. And if that happens, we will finally see LGBT people protected from discrimination in employment, housing, and public services. And that's important because right now it is absolutely legal for a gay person or a transgender person to be fired from their job in Michigan for no reason except that they are gay or that their gender identity and expression doesn't fit what their employer would like it to fit. They need no other reason to fire you. You can be absolutely excellent at your job. Your job performance does not factor into it. They can fire you just for that fact or how they perceive your sexual orientation to be or your gender identity or expression. And that does happen. At Equality Michigan, we are a victim services agency. We do work on a number of discrimination cases, and employment discrimination cases are a number of those cases. It does happen. So we do need to see this amendment pass, and we need to see gender identity and expression a part of that amendment. There is talk right now about it passing with just sexual orientation, and that is something that if it is brought up during lame duck with just sexual orientation and not gender identity and expression as part of the amendment, then the entire LGBT movement will pull out of support for that. So I think people should be on the lookout for that. This is a very important move. We've been working on it for a long time. This initiative is essential to the protection of the LGBTQ community. But if it ends up being proposed by Republicans without protection for gender identity and gender expression, which would protect gender nonconforming people or the transgender community, the entire LGBTQ community will pull support because the community that is most affected by discrimination is the transgender community in all of those areas, discrimination and employment, housing, and public services. And we will not move forward on this legislation unless that is included in the amendment.
There have been some lawmakers who say that they want to add protections against discrimination, but they want that balanced with religious liberty. Do you see that as realistic, or do you think that if discrimination comes in conflict with someone's religious beliefs that you've got to pick a side?
Well, that is an interesting argument. I don't see validity in that argument in that we already have a U.S. Constitution that protects that. We absolutely believe that everybody's religious liberties should be protected. There is no arguing against that. And we want to make sure that everybody's religious freedoms are protected. Our argument is that their religious freedoms are protected. And through the U.S. Constitution, there is a direct route challenging any infringement on religious freedoms, and that is to go directly through the courts. Now, there may be a way to restate that, and we're exploring ways to restate that. If there needs to be something written that says specifically this is what the law says, perhaps we may need to explore that. We don't know. So we're going to see what comes up as we're talking about it, but we really don't support a religious exemption in any civil rights law. Under Elliot Larson, there are protections for religious views. You can't be fired for any religious rights or religious freedoms, religious beliefs. There are already protections written into Elliot Larson for religion. And under the Constitution, you already have the right to have autonomy based on your religious freedoms. So regardless of anything, churches will still be able to have their own decisions about their hiring practices and such, and religious schools. We can't impact that. So a lot of these arguments that we hear about religious freedoms being infringed upon because of us wanting to add these protections for LGBT people into the Civil Rights Act, they are red herrings. They don't apply. We already have those protections, and they're just said to scare people away from protecting LGBT people because we do already have those in place.
In August, a hate crimes awareness coalition was formed in Kalamazoo. That was after a lesbian couple's house was vandalized. Can you give us an idea of how big a problem hate crimes of that magnitude are across the state?
Yes, a much bigger problem than the average person would assume. I think that the average Michigander feels safe walking down the street, feels safe going into their house, feels safe holding hands in public. And the average LGBT citizen does not, which is also why things like Pride festivals are such a relief to the LGBTQ community. I think a lot of people think of them as festivals or parties to the LGBTQ community. And we think of those things as safe spaces because they are one of the few places and times where we feel safe being able to hold our partner's hands. Because otherwise, throughout the year, it does not feel safe to be walking down the street holding our partner's hands because we don't know how the people that we're walking by will react, because it is not an unusual thing to be threatened. And whether that's verbal, whether that's something actually happening to us, it is not an unusual thing to get a aggressive reaction from a stranger still in this day and age, regardless of whether the public polls in favor of our freedom and fairness or not. It is a regular reaction still to the LGBTQ community to have aggression and hostility expressed towards us. And it is something that we see at Equality Michigan, particularly regularly. It is especially violence towards the transgender community, towards trans women of color, especially in very high numbers. We see incidences of violence, and it's something that needs to be acknowledged and combated.
Emily Diefendorf, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Our interview with Michigan Equality Director Emily Diefendorf was recorded on Tuesday. Yesterday, House Republicans announced they will introduce bills to expand the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act to include protections for sexual orientation, but not gender identity. Equality Michigan issued a statement calling the proposal inadequate and said lawmakers should reject it. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Last week, voters rejected two state laws in Michigan designed to allow wolf hunting in the Upper Peninsula. Those votes are seen as largely symbolic. The legislature approved a voter-initiated law that takes effect in March, allowing the Natural Resources Commission to designate game species. That is expected to lead to a wolf hunt next year. Nancy Gibson is the co-founder of the International Wolf Center in Ely, Minnesota. Nancy Gibson, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So your organization noted this vote this week, put out a press release and a statement on it. What should we read into this as Michigan residents as we consider the whole big issue of wolf hunting?
Well, I think it just continues the tradition of the wolf being an extremely controversial animal. And it has, the foes of wolves have not escaped politics throughout history. And this is just another example. However, the ballot question certainly was a new format.
Are there other states that are dealing with the issue of wolf hunting, and is the political process playing out there as well, perhaps differently?
It's the political process and the judicial process. Earlier this year, a federal judge told the state of Wyoming that they could not hunt wolves anymore until they had figured out a better way to comply with the Endangered Species Act. So that stopped the hunting season in Wyoming. And the Wyoming legislature had designated a large portion of Wyoming as they were classified as a varmint, so they could be shot on site. And in other parts, they allowed a little too close to Yellowstone, some of the radio-collared wolves were shot, and that started a public upheaval. So Wyoming is certainly one of them. Hunting with dogs in Wisconsin has been extremely controversial, and that's got into the political process. So usually wherever wolves are present, it is hard to escape the politics of it.
And are we hearing more about this issue now because of more wolves being sighted or more wolves being seen? And is that a reflection of the wolf not being an endangered species any longer?
I think all of the above is probably true. The wolf numbers have increased, and we need to give a lot of credit to the wolves themselves. and people are seeing more wolves than they are perceiving them or actually seeing them interact with deer, and some people have some strong possessional qualities about deer and other people don't. But there are controversies from the religious eras have been surrounded, wolves have been just surrounded by those controversies, and the Europeans brought it over to the United States, and there was a war on predators in 1914 that just tried to wipe out cougars, bears, and wolves, but wolves really took the brunt of the controversy.
So you're saying there's more that goes into the whole debate on wolves than just figuring out how the food chain, for instance, might be affected by wolf activity.
Yes, the perception of wolves, it's so steeped in legends and myths, and as much as science tries to counter some of that information, you really have to work hard to get past some of those old husband's tales, as I call them, to get to the real root of the actual and the science of wolves.
So give us a thumbnail sketch. What is the science of wolves? Are we, for instance, in danger of wolves going back to being an endangered species?
I don't think at this point we're in any threat of the wolves being going back to an endangered species. In fact, we're seeing wolves doing what wolves do, which is dispersing very long distances into other locations to form new packs. And we're seeing those animals coming. They're having to go through some very crowded areas, human habitat, and then trying to resettle. And it's a difficult time for a wolf because as they're dispersing, they're leaving their home territory, they're going into new territory, and they're trying to find a mate. And so the food issues, they need to eat. Sometimes livestock is a little more available and easier to prey on than the wild animals. And so it really gets to be a challenge for wolves, but they are succeeding. And the issue in Michigan is a prime example. Wolves from Minnesota went down south of Duluth, traversed over into Wisconsin, and then left Wisconsin, went over to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. The recovered number of wolves in Michigan was originally supposed to be 50 wolves. You are now between 600 and 700 wolves. So this really says a lot about the wolf just as an animal itself and the fact that it can travel long distances unseen and without conflict. But then once they get established, that's where some of the conflict gets started. And they certainly do eat livestock, a very small percentage. But if it is your income, it is a problem.
And right, I was just going to say, if you're a farmer in the Upper Peninsula and you hear 600 to 700 wolves, that figure that you gave us, do you start to worry that your livelihood is going to be affected by the number of wolves who are in the general vicinity?
If a wolf goes into an area with livestock and is successful, the chance of them repeating that offense is pretty good. Think of it as going into your refrigerator and picking out something easy. The livestock is a much easier source of food for them. And you get into a habit of doing that. And those, it's pretty strong across the board agreement that those offending wolves need to be taken care of. And so that doesn't seem to be as big a controversy. It gets to be a little more when they say, oh, they're going to kill our kids at the school bus stop. They're going to, I can't go running in these areas, and I'm going to be attacked by wolves, all that sort of stuff. Those are from old myths, from the olden days, although there have been a couple incidences in North America where two people have been killed by wolves.
So are people then overreacting if they see a wolf as a threat to human being safety?
Well, let's look at the statistics just in the Boundary Waters canoe area, the wilderness area in northeastern Minnesota. 1 million people have gone into that wilderness, and that place is comfortably populated with wolves, and there's been no problem. So the most likely scenario is that a wolf will hear, smell, and see you long before you see it, and it will avoid you.
So is there a legitimate argument to be made that hunting is a way to address some of the issues that you mentioned, like, you know, livestock being eaten by the wolves? And is there a risk of overpopulation of the wolves? And is hunting a way to remedy that?
A lot of questions here.
Let me take them one at a time.
As I mentioned before, livestock, the taking of livestock is a problem. And what we've seen in Minnesota is that if there has been a high hunting of wolves in some of these agricultural areas, the conflict does go down between farmers and ranchers and wolves. So there is some, you can say there is some success with that. Let's see, the second question was...
Could wolves become overpopulated?
Could wolves become overpopulated? That is probably a judgment call. Wolves will do very well if they have enough vulnerable prey, and they'll also do well enough if they have some protection from humans. So that's what has happened in the last few decades, and their numbers have increased quite a bit. Where there does get to be some problems, if you are wanting to hunt moose or caribou, the wolves will do a number on those if they're in a secluded area, like in a valley between two mountains. That's really, that can be a problem. So does managing them ease some of these problems? Yes, it does. And can wolves withstand it? Yes, they can. In Alaska, they've always hunted wolves, and they can hunt up to about 30% of the wolves, and it does not affect the population.
Do you think that the public is capable of learning enough about the science to make a qualified judgment on this, as, you know, apparently we've tried to do in Michigan with a ballot issue, which again is probably symbolic, you know, or is this one of these things where we should perhaps leave it to the professionals who have been studying this for years or decades, who might have a firmer grasp on what a wolf hunt would mean for Michigan?
I like your second option of allowing the professionals to really take charge on how to manage not just wolves, but bears and raccoons or whatever, or deer. The issue here is the public, and are the politicians smart enough to call upon the experts? And Michigan has Dr. Rolf Peterson, and he has studied wolves for decades. He would be a great person to consult with that, but has he? So we have to get beyond the political appointments for game commissioners and whatnot and try to get into the science of it. If we stick with the science, wolves are going to have a future in the United States. But I think along with that science, we also have to make sure we make some decisions on keeping wild lands, because wolves will do better in wild lands. And I just want to give a little push for the Wolf Center. We have Dr. Rolf Peterson on our board. We also have Dr. Dave Meach, the World's Authority on Wolves. And they are always eager to deal with and talk to politicians and the public so that we can see the best outcome for wolves in wild lands.
What is your greatest fear if the policies set regarding wolves are not based on science?
My greatest fear is the wrong people will be making the wrong decisions with the wrong information. And that's not just detrimental to wolves, it's detrimental to all wildlife. It's just that wolves seem to be at the top of the megafauna list of areas where they want to have the public manage these wolves and other wildlife. So I think we need to put a higher regard on the science and the biology for these controversial issues, and we tend not to. We tend to let politics get in the way, and you tend to listen to this anecdotal evidence about this and this and this and that, which doesn't have any basis in science.
Nancy Gibson, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Nancy Gibson is the co-founder of the International Wolf Center in Ely, Minnesota. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.